Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Black bears behave differently depending on whether hunting is allowed in the area where they live. That's one of the findings from an intensive study of black bears by biologist Dr. Sophie Chetwertynski. And concern over the environment is just one of the drivers behind the interest in biofuels and biomaterials. Bill Hunter gives his vision for a new biofuture. And Dr. Ian Potter explains the new partnership between the Alberta Research Council and Schlumberger to access unconventional sources of natural gas. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. I first met biologist Sophie Chetwertynski in 2001. Sophie had just finished a summer where she had captured and collared 86 black bears in northeastern Alberta. She then followed their movements over the next several years. Some of the bears lived in areas where hunting is allowed, and some lived in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range where hunting is not allowed. The amount of data Sophie gathered was extensive, and many of her findings about the bears were quite surprising. The end result earned Sophie her PhD in January of this year.
We had three study areas. One of them was in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, which is just north of Cold Lake, which is an unhunted bear population. Access is very restricted, and so it's one of those rare areas where there's very little poaching and no official hunting. And then we had two hunted populations that we studied north and south of Conklin, so north of the Air Weapons Range.
What is the question that you were addressing with this research?
Well, back when I started, some questions were coming up on the potential negative effects of hunting bears. And so when I say negative effects, I don't mean killing bears and removing them from the population. People were suggesting that when you removed large adult males that were usually hunted and selected by hunters, you actually caused a disruption in the social system. And what would result is a series of events. And so first you'd have this disruption of the social system, and then you'd possibly have some new immigrant males coming in and this shifting of home ranges. And as a consequence, some biologists were suggesting that females were avoiding these new males, so avoiding good habitats. This was reducing their nutritional condition. As a result, they were having fewer cubs. And on top of it, the cubs that were born were more likely to be killed by these males, new males, and that are encountering new females. The reason for this is that in bears, if an adult male meets a female with cubs, he can kill those cubs, and within 48 hours, the female comes back into estrus, and he can sire his own cubs. And so right now, the way populations are managed is that you account for animals that are removed by harvest, but not for any potential indirect effects. And so my study was really designed to see whether or not these indirect effects were actually occurring, and if they were, how they should be accounted for.
And is that what you found?
We actually found the opposite. We can't say that these indirect effects are not occurring, but what we can say is that if they are occurring, these effects are extremely small and actually don't need to be accounted for. So when we started comparing our hunted and unhunted populations, what we found is that in the hunted area, females actually reproduced at an earlier age, and the cub survival rates were higher than in the unhunted area.
In your study, then, is there anything else that you found that would support that conclusion?
Another really interesting result we found is that in both areas, we equipped bears not only with some regular VHF collars, which you need to fly around and locate bears with, but we also used some radio collars that track bear locations throughout the entire summer hourly using satellite data. And so based on those results, we had information on male and female locations throughout the entire summer, and were able to compare male and female habitat selection throughout those 4 years. What was most interesting out of those results is that in the unhunted area, where we had higher cub mortality, females and males used quite different habitats compared to the hunted area, where there was higher cub survival, and females and males were more likely to use similar habitats. And so this suggested that in areas where there are these larger males, which haven't been removed by hunting, females were actually pushed out of better habitat. And then to further test that, what we did is we removed some of the large adult males from the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, from that unhunted area. And what we found is that the females actually started using better habitat after we removed those males. And so what this really suggests and demonstrates quite clearly is that hunting does not have this effect of destroying the social structure and increasing infanticide and pushing females out of bad habitat. It's what actually affects female cub survival and their movements is the probability of encountering a male, not necessarily the disruption of that social system. And so what that does mean is that we can hunt black bears sustainably, and harvest plans can be based on the number of bears that are removed.
Well, what about their movements then? What were you tracking?
We were not only able to look at the different habitats that bears were using, but also how they moved through space and time. And that was also really interesting between the two populations. What we found is that the females in the unhunted area actually had much smaller home ranges than the females in the hunted area by about a factor of four. But what was even more interesting is that these females between the two areas actually moved on average the same daily distance throughout the breeding period when cubs are most vulnerable. And so if you picture this in your mind, you have two different home range sizes, one four times bigger than the other, and picture bears moving through them exactly the same amount. And so that means that in the unhunted area, you have females moving constantly over these very small areas, whereas in the hunted population, they're just moving not in very specific areas, but over much greater areas, that same amount of distance. And so it really seems like in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range, these females are restricted within these smaller home ranges. And at first we thought, well, maybe it's because there's these larger males in that area. But what happened when we removed those large adult males is actually the females didn't change their behavior at all. They still had these small home ranges, and they were still moving that large amount within these small home ranges. And so what we think is happening is actually that it's not so much the males that are affecting that movement, it's their neighboring females that are restricting them to these smaller home ranges. And so it seems like it's females that are keeping them in this small physical space, but it's the males that are affecting their habitat selection within that small space that they're forced into by other females.
Well, do they eat themselves out of house and home if they're restricted to this small territory?
Actually, the females in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range are doing quite well. They have large litters, and the difficulty where the difference is between the two populations is that it's a much older population in the Cold Lake Air Weapons Range. You find very few younger individuals. And usually when the cubs are old enough to leave the female, they actually disperse quite far out of the air weapons range because you have this high density of individuals.
Well, these are quite incredible differences between the two populations, those in the unhunted area and those in the hunted. Is there anything that comes out of your research results that suggests there should be a change in management of these bears?
As far as the number of bears harvested, they're fairly well managed in Alberta. The results could be used, however, to possibly have a harvest that's more male biased. Females are killed in the harvest simply because they're mistaken for males, unless they're accompanied with cubs. They're very difficult to tell apart. But based on some of our habitat use results, in some areas it might be possible to hunt in areas where you'd be more likely to encounter a male than a female. And so in that way, you could affect the number of females that are in the harvest. So for example, in the boreal mixed wood forest where we're working, it's very possible that if you'd set up hunting sites in riparian areas that are more likely to be used by males than females, hunters would be more likely to shoot males because females would be less likely to be in those areas. So that's just one example of how the results could be used for management.
What are the questions that are still left after having spent this 8 years on this research on these bears?
One of the questions that I find most interesting after being done is really the effect of females on other females, which I really wasn't expecting when I first started the study. So we were kind of set up the study to really look at the effects of males on females. But what I would still be really interested in is what would happen if suddenly out of this really dense female population, for instance, hunting would occur and you'd reduce the female population. How would that affect the habitat use, movement, and structure of these home ranges of these females? So that's definitely a question that I would love to ask, because one thing that we weren't able to tease apart in our study is the influence or the effect possibly of even females killing other female cubs.
Well, Sophie, it's been a long time getting to this point with your study, and you've actually defended your PhD thesis now. Where does that leave you? Do I get to call you doctor yet?
I wish. I just defended 2 days ago, and so I have a few revisions to do. So hopefully next week you can call me doctor.
And what happens now? What research is next on the agenda for you?
I just moved to Whitehorse in the fall, and right now I'm doing some work for Dr. Fiona Schmigelow, working on caribou, and I'm hoping to possibly work on a bison study that might be starting up there.
And what's the concern with bison?
Actually, it's a really interesting question. They've reintroduced bison in the Yukon, and the population is doing extremely well. So it's actually a very interesting management question, because it's the opposite of most cases where species are not doing well. So one of the questions they have is whether bison are actually competing with caribou and moose for some habitat.
Congratulations, Sophie, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Sophie Chetrutinsky, a recent PhD graduate from the University of Alberta. Her research on black bears was supported in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. Concern over greenhouse gas emissions, climate change, water conservation, and the loss of our natural forests are just a few of the drivers behind the quest to find alternatives to fossil fuels. Enter the new age of biomaterials and the bioeconomy. In Alberta, one of the biggest promoters of the bioeconomy is Bill Hunter. Ever a visionary, Bill started investigating alternative sources of fiber for pulp when he was president and chief operating officer of Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Since retiring from that position in 2004, he's helped develop programs that would bring foresters and farmers together to grow the bioresources of the future. I asked Bill what first attracted him to the new field of bioeconomics.
In my tenure at LPAC, I was able to work with a very, very intelligent team of people who knew that we could make significant profits for our shareholders by getting the maximum value from the natural resources around us. At the same time, I was blessed with a significant biology team that also said, yes, but there are more than just profits at the forefront of why we're here and what we're about to do. And through ALPAC's reputation on integrated landscape management and ecosystem management and triple bottom line concepts, as I retired, and because of our interaction at the very end with our poplar plantation opportunities working with regional farmers, I'm still very, very committed to there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a way of fulfilling the customers' needs worldwide in the arena of pulp and paper and construction materials, but it doesn't always have to be the natural forest as the feedstock for that opportunity. Science and innovation and the research and the technology that's been developed over the last couple of years affords us the opportunity to experiment and look at the different fiber makeups to create the final products that consumers are expecting. So through a litany of boards and research institutes that I've participated in, that only emphasized and enhanced my opinion about we can do this in a different way and still suffice or still protect our consumers' ability to buy the products they need for day-to-day needs.
What might some of the alternatives be?
Well, I think that agriculture is a good starting point. They can grow, because we have great growing conditions in this province, they can grow what I interpret as industrial feedstocks that in the end can represent the feed materials for biofuels, bioelectricity, biomaterials, biochemicals, those things that we use the petroleum industry to support right now. I think we can offset or complement that opportunity by using not so much the primary, like oilseed crops and those things, but even the stalks and the straws, which constitute cellulose, we can design quite a few commodity products that we use today.
Is the technology for these alternatives advanced enough now that, say, within 5 years we could see a switchover?
I think so. Conversion technology has existed in Europe for 25 years, so it would be first-generation conversion technology. The Europeans started a long time ago because the value of energy costs were so high in Europe, they had to look at alternatives. We've had the lucrative position of having fairly cheap energy in North America, especially in Canada and Alberta. But as that starts to climb, we've hit $100 barrel of oil just recently. We're starting to look at those same conversion technologies and using organic materials and biomass to complement the product lines that we're already seeing.
What would it take in a province like Alberta to make that change?
Leadership. I've always said that Alberta has a cancer. It's called rich, fat, and lazy. So there's no sense of urgency. We are our strong suit is the energy sector. We need it. It's part of our going forward, but managed in a diversified portfolio with complementary types of industries like the bioeconomy, I think we could set ourselves up so the graduating class of 2025 is in good shape.
Can you give me some specific examples?
We think that in the context from the environmental side, in the context of green solutions, so what I mean by that is zero waste communities, zero waste enterprises, integrated industrial parks, co-products. One man's waste or garbage is another man's input or gold, and we need to embrace that and move forward with it. And I think it's very doable. In 10 years, we could probably have five major regional integrated industrial parks in this province. The problem we have is Canadians are notorious for being the suppliers of raw materials and not investors in the manufacturing facilities and the value-added component. So it's like we're from Missouri. We have to see, touch, smell, and kick something before we'll actually make that that capital investment. So perhaps a P3 relationship between government and industry and research and the university says, let's build these demonstration opportunities across the province so the Missourians can go and do all the things they have to do to be able to retool their existing commodities. The forest industry is a wonderful example. Not wonderful. They're in terrible shape. But it's a great example of those who need to really think about what their future looks like because for the most part, lumber and OSB and other panel products are not doing very good because of the U.S. market. And I don't see that turning around for another 18, 24 months. So you got to be able to create revenue to make sure you keep your assets running and your people employed, or they're going to move off and go to the energy sector.
You mentioned a novel idea, these integrated parks. Is anyone showing any interest at this time?
Actually, I'm glad you asked that. My time in the last 4 months is almost at least 75% of my time is working with different regional economical development agencies and or specific communities. For instance, the Palliser region, which is sort of Medicine Hat up to Brooks and over to the Saskatchewan border, are very interested in looking at value-added integrated parks for their area. Drayton Valley, a great community that has issues with Weyerhaeuser's OSB plant shutting down. They're looking at what can we do to support Weyerhaeuser and diversify our economy. Hinton's another great example. They've developed their own park now. They've got the land, but now they need the tenants to support it. Just north of Eggerville in the Harry Hills area, the Highmark Renewables gang have announced their bar refinery, so we're going to assist and help them develop that concept so that they attract more complementary industries there, because I think that's going to be a great model.
How do we deal with climate change in the future? What can we do to conserve water resources? The bioeconomy, what role is it going to play in solving those two issues?
That's a great question. And so water comes to the forefront, and water is going to be a major issue going forward. It's because of research, innovation, and science that we can look at mitigation strategies or new ways of creating and manufacturing products that uses less water. We should be putting a lot of money there. The bioeconomy says that if you have specific industrial feedstock crops that you make for a biomaterial or a biochemical can be bred to be drought tolerant, so we can adapt to climate change. We can't necessarily turn it. But the amount of CO2 emissions, SO2, NOx, and others can be a benefit from the different types of new bioeconomy products or bioindustrial products that we get into. Still lots of research is needed, and that's why we need some really great scientists. Maybe borrow from the Europeans, because they've gone there before us and learned the hard lessons. We could bypass that and go straight to some of the victories and eurekas just by investing in technology.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thanks, Cheryl. It's always good to talk to you.
That was Bill Hunter, former president and chief operating officer of Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Bill's a past president of the Alberta Chamber of Resources. He has chaired the Alberta Forest Research Institute and the Alberta Life Sciences Institute. He's a member of ASRA, the Alberta Science and Research Authority. And he recently chaired the Premier's Royalty Review Panel. Alberta's geological formations are riddled with fossil fuels like oil, gas, and coal. But getting those resources out of the ground is not always easy. And as concern rises over dwindling supplies of conventional natural gas, there's more interest in finding cost-effective ways to exploit some harder-to-recover sources of gas. That's the motivation behind a new collaboration between the Alberta Research Council and Schlumberger, one of the largest energy service companies in the world. Dr. Ian Potter is the Vice President of Energy for the Alberta Research Council.
Without getting into the nuances and definitional things, I'll leave that to the Department of Energy and the Alberta Geological Survey. But conventional natural gas is, as the term implies, you drill a hole, you complete it, natural gas comes out without much processing. Unconventional is normally reserved for areas of coal bed methane, tight gas and shale gas in the province. And it's those unconventional resources that aren't traditionally exploited. They're a little bit more costly to exploit rather than the historical decades of natural gas production that we've had within the province. And the unconventional gas, really, I mean, the one that's taken the press in the last few years has been the coal bed methane side of it, although we've seen a growing amount of shale gas development over the last couple of years as people have tried to exploit that resource.
Well, what is shale gas reserve?
It's the way the gas is actually stored geologically in the type of media that it's stored in, the geological structure of that. That refers to the shale itself, and the gas is then stored within the shale itself.
The Alberta Research Council has just developed a partnership with Schlumberger to look at some of these specific unconventional gas reserves. What is it that you're trying to do here?
The technical difficulties of getting to some of these unconventional reserves are very high. They're difficult to get at reserves, and that relates to then the cost of production. And the role that we play is how can we improve the economic development of the province in actually opening up some of these resources in a sustainable manner? So applying different technologies to the shale gas to make it a little bit more easy to exploit, reduce the cost of actually production. So the relationship, I prefer the word collaboration with Schlumberger, is a part of an ongoing way that ARC is helping the province develop these resources. And it's a program that we've operated for many years now, way before my time at ARC. But it's obviously becoming more front and center as the decline in natural gas production continues. And there are new plays being exploited in natural gas, but fundamentally, the natural gas production is on the decline, and we have huge resources in unconventional, whether it's coal bed methane or shale gas, that are waiting to be exploited in a sustainable manner. And so if we can put the technology in place that will reduce the cost, it's a huge opportunity for the province to sustain the gas industry in the province itself.
Well, what might be some of that technology that you're working on?
Different ways of drilling and completions. We have Alberta has a very strong background in horizontal drilling. How do we use horizontal drilling to its best effect in shales? Is it the most appropriate technology? That's from a drilling perspective, but one of the biggest issues is the actual permeability, or the ability to actually get the gas out of the shale itself. And that's what the initial relationship and collaboration with Schlumberger will look at. How do we actually permeate break, if you like, allow the crevices to open up so we can extract the gas, the natural gas, out of the shale? And what type of media is the best to actually fracture those geological formations in the first place? Is it a gas? What type of gas? What pressure? Or is it a liquid? Those sort of things. And how do we then make sure that we fracture in a controlled manner, get the gas out in a controlled manner without any environmental liability and at low cost, fundamentally.
How long do you think it will take before you get some results?
Generically, research programs in this sort of activity can be 8 to 15 years. I would hope that in 3 to 5 years, if not less, we could have realistic demonstration pilots out in the field now with an operator. And we could probably move to it today. But I think we need to do a little bit more due diligence on understanding what we need to do and how we need to do it effectively. It's unwise just to go out there and play. It's not a good process.
That was Dr. Ian Potter, the Vice President of Energy for the Alberta Research Council. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.